Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. And two guests up for today's show. First, in a little while, we'll speak with Max Blumenthal, whose new book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement that Shattered the Party, the Republican Party, that is, just out from Nation Books. And at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with a fellow who's been on this show several times before, more than several times, I think, Michael Yates, a retired economist who is now traveling across the U.S. and filing dispatches from this great land, out also with a new book, In and Out of the Working Class. We'll talk to him about that and his experience working with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers and the state of the American working class today and many other such matters. But before all that, some words on the economic news. Thursday morning brought the release of the annual income, poverty, and health insurance numbers from the Census Bureau for 2008. As you might have guessed, the first year of the recession was pretty bad news for just about everyone. Median household income, the income right at the middle of the income distribution, with half of all households having higher incomes and half lower, that fell by 3.6% last year, the biggest yearly decline since these figures began in 1967. All racial and ethnic groups took a hit. Non-Hispanic whites were off 2.6%, blacks 2.8%, Asians 4.4%, and so-called Hispanics were off by 5.6%. That's all those figures are adjusted for inflation. Households of all ages lost income in 2008, with the exception of the over 65 set, who are protected by the cost of living increases in Social Security. But everyone younger than that, not so lucky. A few points. The one-year hit to incomes in 2008 is on a par with the multi-year hits taken in earlier recessions. For example, the 3.6% decline last year is larger than the decline we saw in the recession and weak recovery years of 1999 to 2002. 3 years of damage then more than condensed into 1 year of damage last year. And 2008 was only the beginning of the recessions. Job losses didn't accelerate, and unemployment didn't really spike higher until the fall of last year. The Economic Policy Institute estimates that this year's decline in incomes is likely to be larger in the 4.5% to 5% range. If anything like that happens, the total decline of over 8% in 2 years will be the biggest recession hit to income since these numbers began 42 years ago. That's coming after the weakest expansion in modern history. Gains during the 2001 to 2007 cycle expansion weren't enough to reverse the declines of the previous recession years, the first time that that's happened ever. So before this recession is over, and I mean not in the formal sense, but in the sense of how average people experience the economy, measured by their household incomes and employment, these incomes are likely to be 10% below where they were in 1999. A 10% decline in 10 years, that's not the way America is supposed to work. But the rich were a little luckier. A technical note before proceeding. These census figures are derived from a survey of households. Because very rich people don't answer such surveys, and because there are so few of them that it'd be hard to find enough of them to make for a meaningful sample, these annual reports miss things at the very high end. But you can get that kind of data from tax returns, which are available only with a delay of several years. The economists Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez do just that, and their 2007 numbers were recently released. So in their measure, while the bottom 90% of the population saw its income decline between 1999 and 2007, the richest 1% gained about 7%. The richest one-tenth, or rather one-one-hundredth of 1%, 0.01%, that's about 30,000 people, saw their incomes rise over that 8-year period by 25%. Everyone down, but the very rich up 25%. Not surprisingly, the poverty rate rose to 13.2% in 2008. That's up half a point from a year earlier. That's the highest level since 1997. The Economic Policy Institute estimates that it will rise another 1.5 points this year to 14.7%, which would be the highest since 1992. For whites, the poverty rate was 11.2%. For blacks, almost 25%, more than twice as high. Among Latinos, it was almost as bad, 23%. But some definitions are in order. Official poverty is defined as a pre-tax income under a specified amount that varies with family size. For a family of four last year, the line was around $22,000 of income a year. This is a very undemanding standard. More honest definitions of poverty would set the line closer to $30,000, which would raise the poverty rate to 20 or 25%. And these figures are just snapshots of a given year. According to the Census Bureau, over the four-year period ending in 2007, almost a third, 31%, of all Americans had at least one period under the official poverty line lasting 2 months or more. For a very rich country, we have a lot of poor people, and they are often very poor. Finally, the number of people without health insurance rose by about 600,000 last year to 46.3 million. Measured as a share of the population, however, the uninsured remained at a constant 15.4%. But that means without insurance for the entire year, many more people had bouts of uninsurance that didn't last the whole year, so the actual count of uninsurance is considerably higher than the official 15.4%. And again, since the economy of 2009 was worse than 2008, the current levels are probably a lot higher. The Economic Policy Institute estimates that it's probably up by another 5 million this year. But apparently that's not the way the Obama administration wants to count the uninsured. According to a very useful piece by Politico's Carrie Budoff Brown on what Obama said Wednesday night's during Wednesday night's health reform speech versus what he actually meant, the administration says there are only 30 million uninsured, more than 16 million, about a third below what the Census Bureau just said there was. Well, where'd that 16 million go? Well, about 10 million are undocumented immigrants, so they're not worth talking about. Another 5 or 7 million people are those who could go on Medicaid but have not for God knows what reason. Presto, we've got the count down to 30 million. That's a nice way to lower the bar, isn't it? And what a disappointing speech it was on Wednesday night. Well, no, I can't say that exactly since I hadn't expected much, but it is terrible policy. The core of it is to require all of us to buy health insurance from private companies. With a $3,800 penalty if we don't, according to Max Baucus's Senate Finance Committee proposal. Subsidies will be available for people with incomes up to $66,000 or $88,000, depending upon which of the four bills floating around that you read, but it will still be quite a burden for a lot of us to buy this very expensive health insurance. So instead of getting rid of the insurance companies and their diabolical profits, executive bonuses, claims denials, and administrative costs, the president will be delivering them tens of millions of new customers under the sanction of a $3,800 fine. This will do nothing to reduce costs, either. Medical inflation is likely to continue to rise unabated. And what about that public option? Well, as Brown's article on Politico.com reports, the insurance company said that except the reforms requiring them to embrace everyone, pre-existing conditions or no, only if the government forced us all to become their customers. And the so-called public option, the government-run insurance company, would have to pay its way without any public subsidies, meaning its premiums would probably be on a par with or only slightly lower than private insurers. And still, that public option is maybe too much to get through the Senate, the seven or eight Blue Dog Democrats there are not likely to vote for a bill with a public option. So if it's there, it'll be weak, but it's not likely to be there at all. A friend pointed out to me the other day that the market capitalization, the value of all the outstanding stock, of the publicly traded health insurance companies is about $150 billion. Add a little premium to sweeten the pot, and you could nationalize a lot of them for about $200 billion. The total administrative costs of the U.S. healthcare system, which are greatly inflated by all the paperwork and second-guessing of doctors' decisions generated by the insurance companies, are about $400 billion a year. Those administrative costs are about three times what a Canadian single-payer system would cost. So that means we'd save about $250 billion a year by eliminating the waste caused by our private insurance system. In other words, a nationalization of the health insurance industry could pay for itself in well under a year in all the administrative cost savings. We can't do that. It'd be Canadian or something. A feature of the speech, it does seem like the magic of the marketplace holds sway. We're still in the president and the rest of our elite is still under the discursive grasp of Ronald Reagan. And also, the president closed his speech by saying, "God bless America," an innovation introduced to American speechifying by Ronald Reagan. So the old Gipper still lives on, even in this era of changiness. Meanwhile, it seems like a whole lot of liberals and Democrats and progressives, or whatever you want to call them, support health insurance reform without really knowing what's in it. Acorn sent around a missive on Thursday afternoon urging us to call our senators to stand up to the insurance companies. Stand up for them seems more like it, given what's actually in the reform proposals. Elise Hoag, the spokestool for MoveOn.org, said in her Facebook status update after the president's speech that that was the president she had elected. She personally? I think she had some help there. But anyway, maybe if she thought that the president that she elected was corporate friendly, then she got what she asked for. But I don't think that's what she really meant. She's just going on instinct. And David Sirota, the progressive columnist, had a piece that got circulated on Thursday morning saying that the speech sounded like to him, like something delivered by Rahm Emanuel. But actually, it was by Barack Obama. It's always the advisors and never the king that's at fault, isn't it? It does seem to me that all these liberals and progressives and such who support the president are doing so mainly because his opponents are such ignorant and bigoted cretins. They are that. There's no question about it. What they're supporting is not all that much to write home about. The president's opponents, even though they are nutty and repulsive in many ways, are actually fight tirelessly for what they believe in. I wish I could say the same for our side. Okay, let's take a musical break. And that's some of Bad Religion's I Want to Conquer the World, Give All the Idiots a Brand New Religion, from 1989. And that, by way of introducing Max Blumenthal, who now joins us, he is the author of Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, the Republican Party, that is. Welcome to Behind the News, Max.
Hey, great to be here.
We have a nice news hook in that yet another Republican politician caught in a sex scandal. This is the fellow from Orange County, caught bragging on a microphone that he didn't know was open about his sexual conquest. What is it about these Republicans and their sex scandals?
Well, none of them are necessarily unique, as long as these are people who proclaim themselves to be family values Republicans, whether they're Mark Sanford, who's an ordained Baptist minister and a favorite of the Christian right, or John Ensign, the only Pentecostal serving in the Senate, or Ted Haggard, Mark, to some degree Mark Foley, Larry Craig, who was the third most conservative senator in the Senate during his career. Their scandals really aren't unique. What they all have in common is they all stem from this pessimistic and conflicted view that people who are adherents of the Christian right have of the self. They believe that the self, as Mike Huckabee, another ordained Baptist minister and Republican politician, said, is sinful, that man does not have, this is a Huckabee quote, that man does not have a God nature, he has a sin nature. Or as Mark Sanford said in his press conference, confessing to his affair on state money with his Latin lover, that the reason we follow God's law is not, you know, for its own sake, not just for spiritual reasons, but to restrain ourselves from ourselves. And so these people need to do what they think God wants them to do, because if they start doing what they want to do, what they will do will range anywhere from extramarital affairs to man-on-dog sex. And, you know, it could be said that the Republican Party, by welcoming in the Christian right and allowing the Christian right and its dysfunctional personalities into its ranks and its leadership, has developed a pre-existing condition.
And of course, we shouldn't forget David Vitter and his diapers, but not, of course.
No, and David Vitter is a major topic of my book, and it's amazing that he's actually able to run for re-election and be a favorite in Louisiana after having an affair with a high-priced prostitute.
I just want to make it clear that there's nothing necessarily wrong with diapers. It's just that you shouldn't go around preaching to other people about how to live their lives if you're going to wear them. But it is This is commonly attributed to hypocrisy, but in your book, you make a more psychological argument about the flight for freedom. Could you lay that out?
My book was inspired by a book called Escape from Freedom by the psychiatrist Eric Fromm. It was written in 1941, and Fromm's basic thesis, you know, if I can boil it down into one sentence, is anyone who can't handle the pressures of freedom in an open society will inevitably turn authoritarian. And so my book is a portrait of a movement that now controls the Republican Party substantially, that's populated by figures who had suffered some massive personal crisis and were unable to deal with the pressures of secular democratic society, so they became attracted to the authoritarian confines of the Christian right and, you know, assorted groups in the radical right.
So these are people who are, many of whom suffer internal demons that they're not comfortable with, so they deal with them by running around trying to oppress other people.
Absolutely. Their crusade to cleanse the land of sin is really, you know, done in hopes that they can cleanse their own souls. Whether it's, you know, Leslie Unruh, the leading anti-abortion activist in South Dakota and one of the country's leading abstinence-only education advocates, who had an abortion when she was younger, then converted to Christianity and, you know, began a campaign to ban abortion even in cases of rape and incest, that almost succeeded, or Howard F. Amundson Jr., the sugar daddy of the Christian right, who funded Prop 8, the anti-gay bill in California, who inherited $300 million from his father at age 18, then promptly and literally went crazy and was committed to an mental institution for 2 years, then emerged to become a born-again Christian and the financial angel of R.J. Rush Dooney, who I talk about in my book as the father of Christian Reconstructionism.
I want to talk about him a moment. Now, I spent some time many years ago as a right-winger myself, so some of these names are not unfamiliar to me, but they are unfamiliar, I think, to most people. Rush Dooney is something of a god to the nutty right, so who is he and what did he have to say?
Yeah, and I think they wouldn't even admit that he's their god, but he did give the Christian right its blueprint for the society it hoped to create, or at least emulate in a diluted way when it first became politicized and radicalized in the 60s, when the evangelical movement became radicalized. Rush Dooney was the descendant of six generations of Armenian high priests and was a survivor of the Armenian genocide. When he came to the United States and had concluded that the secular world was morally depraved, he mapped out a system in which the church would replace the underpinnings of secular government and would perform functions like road building, schooling, and health care. So he helped inspire right-wing libertarianism. It also, his system would also replace, which he called Christian Reconstructionism, would also replace the criminal justice system with Leviticus case law. So the disobedient children, adulterers, abortion doctors, loose women, etc., witches, blasphemers, would all be executed, perhaps by firing squad, and you could call this the Christian right's trigger option.
Yes, or it's like the Christian version of the Taliban justice.
Oh, absolutely, and, you know, the inspiration for Al-Qaeda, Saeed Qutb, had a similar experience when he came to the United States briefly and decided that this country was morally depraved and the world would have to be replaced by some sort of theocracy.
Well, as George W. might say, they hate our freedom.
They hate our freedom. And unfortunately, he could also be referring to his political base.
I was speaking with Max Blumenthal, who is the author of Republican Gomorrah, the Inside the Movement that Shattered the Party, the Republican Party, that is, just out from Nation Books. Now, of course, the Republican Party wasn't always dominated by these folks. It is now a very regional and religious party, and an aging party to some degree, but it wasn't always such. When did these folks really take things over?
I think during the 1970s, once they identified tactics that could allow them to insinuate themselves into the mainstream, through another, you know, eccentric figure, Francis Schaeffer, who was at one time running a hippie Christian commune in the Swiss Alps, but descended, you know, kind of airdropped himself into Washington after Roe v. Wade, when he became radicalized against abortion and believed that the government had a plan to implement death panels. He was able to evangelize much of the Republican congressional leadership at the time. He was a frequent guest at the Ford White House, and he sold people like Jerry Falwell, who were preoccupied with fighting racial integration in the South, on fighting abortion instead, and actually using Martin Luther King's tactics to stop abortion. By the end of his life, in the early 80s, Schaefer was advocating domestic terrorism, force in the defensive posture to stop abortion, and inspired groups like Operation Rescue, which are responsible for the assassination of Dr. Tiller. And lots of money started, you know, coming into the Christian right because of this nexus between the Christian right and the Republican Party. And this money, you know, fueled the Reagan Revolution, and the Christian right managed to integrate itself into the conservative counter-establishment in Washington, to the point where, by the rise of George W. Bush, by George W. Bush's re-election, it had reached the mountaintop and could see the promised land on the other side, which was Rush Dooney's theocratic republic. Unfortunately for them, because of the mentality of the movement, because of its dysfunctional, conflicted sensibility, that theocratic dream of a new Canaan in America wound up transforming quite rapidly into a Republican Gomorrah.
I didn't want to introduce any Oedipal issues into this conversation, but you used the word counter-establishment, and it reminded me your father wrote a very fine book called The Rise of the Counter-Establishment about the neoconservative and corporate move in the late 1970s, early 1980s, move to the right, and their realization in the Reagan years. What is the relation between the Christianization of the Republican Party and that rise of the conservative counter-establishment, which was much more business, economic-oriented than the fundamentalists?
My father described was sort of an elite conservative movement funded by industry money, financiers like Richard Mellon Scaife, who were involved in the extraction industries, who needed front groups to change the public discussion, which had become too democratic for them and too far to the left. By creating think tanks and journals, they were able to shift the discussion back to the right. But they didn't have the shock troops they needed, so they relied on the Christian right to transform a top-heavy movement into at least a party that could dominate throughout the Sun Belt. And interestingly, figures like Richard Mellon Scaife have funded some Christian right initiatives, like the effort mostly funded by Howard F. Amundson Jr., who I mentioned before, to foment a schism within the mainline churches, which are just another square on the chessboard that the right wants to conquer. So the Christian right always served an instrumental purpose for these big business groups. The problem is, and I think they underestimated the extremism of the Christian right, and now the party has been set against itself. Elite figures within the party would like, Beltway consultants recognize that they've marginalized the party, that the Christian right's marginalized the party, and that they can only win in the Sun Belt in heavily white evangelical areas because episodes provoked by this Christian right influence in the Republican Party, like the Terri Schiavo affair, turned off mainstream America. And so there's a conflict that's brewing right now over how to rebuild the Republican Party, or whether the Republican Party should simply double down on the Christian right. And I think they've chosen the latter option. And we're seeing with the reaction to Representative Joe Wilson's outburst last night that the Republican Party is very comfortable with these southern evangelical right-wing elements remaining their voice.
Well, yes, I was watching Obama's speech. I was thinking, and listening to the heckling coming from Republicans, I was thinking that the corporate establishment, the Wall Street establishment, must now actually feel far more comfortable with the Democratic Party than they do with what used to be thought of as the corporate Republican Party, because it is so much in the grip now of these populist evangelical lunatics. What does that do to our political landscape to have this one insane right-wing party, a centrist corporate party, and then what else is there?
Well, I do think there is at least a nascent progressive movement within the Democratic Party that's been slightly cowed by Obama, and I think hitched its wagon too tightly to his star during the primaries and the general election. And they're having trouble building opposition to him. The conservative movement would have never functioned like this. They're always comfortable throwing rocks from the outside, and actually they function best that way. So I think the progressive movement needs to find its own voice, you know, and needs to listen to Obama and his words last night when he said, my progressive friends on the one side and my Republican friends on the other side, you know, believe this, and we have to stop these partisan wars. So he's positioning himself in an imaginary center, which can't hold, and which will eventually wind up creating a void in the White House that'll be filled by, you know, corporate interests and corporate initiatives. So it's really up to the grassroots progressive movement, which has been cowed by Obama, to start running ads against Blue Dog Democrats, start going after people like Max Baucus, and not just focus on the radical right, which is doing a good enough job of destroying itself.
Yeah, I do worry sometimes that focusing on the radical right makes it too easy for the rest of us, because they are frightening lunatics. There's no question about it. But it sort of absolves a lot of people on the progressive side from developing and fighting for an agenda.
It's really difficult in Washington right now for the progressive groups. They have these common purpose meetings with members of the Obama administration. And, you know, Jane Hampshire wrote about how Rahm Emanuel went to one of these meetings and personally threatened all these groups and threatened to cut off their donors if they ran ads against the Blue Dog Democrats who were intransigent on health care. So it's a difficult time. It is easier going after the radical right. Definitely, you know, I'm having a good time with it. And they keep producing these new and bizarre scandals every week.
Well, they are a threatening and terrifying force. I don't want to take that away from them.
How about Heath Shuler, who's a Democrat from Tennessee? He's a member of the C Street House. Why doesn't anyone talk about that?
But I don't want to let you get away without reviewing some of Sarah Palin's theological roots. I was really a little surprised to hear just how nutty her theological masters are. Could you tell us about the world that produced her?
Yeah, it's actually, you know, an entire book could be written about this, but I devoted a chapter or two to it. But I'll just tell you a personal journalistic story of going to her church, the Wasilla Assembly of God, in Wasilla, Alaska, during the campaign. She doesn't belong to the church anymore. She remains a friend of it, but she was baptized there and spent 20 years in it. And I saw a sermon by a man named Bishop Thomas Muthi, who is a Pentecostal pastor from Kenya, who says that he advertises his credentials as a witch hunter, who's able to catch witches and the spirit of witchcraft out of entire areas. And he had anointed Sarah Palin against the spirit of witchcraft in 2005. When I saw him speak, he led the crowd in a really intense prayer against witchcraft and the python spirit, then passed the mic off to another pastor who had the crowd pray to put their feet against the heads of the enemy and step on the necks of the enemy.
The enemy would be you and me, right?
The enemy would be us. This, according to their theology, the third wave, you know, which is called the third wave, and you know, to explain that phrase would take probably too much time. But they believe that demons possess entire areas, buildings, cities, even countries, and that they have to engage in prayer and form cell groups and recruit as many converts within those cities and within those areas to cast out the demons. So Ted Haggard, who the fallen preacher from Colorado Springs, who also believed in this, was seen early on when he was trying to build his congregation in Colorado Springs with a garden sprayer filled with Crisco oil anointing intersections to cast out what he called, a really bloody Satanism, and he warned that there were covens still in Colorado Springs left over from the 60s.
Well, I've heard of creative uses of Crisco, but that really takes it.
He's the Crisco kid.
But finally, as I recall, the theology, this third wave theology, also holds that Satan mated with Eve to produce Cain, and Cain's descendants are the intellectuals. So we are all the spawn of Satan, correct?
We are the python spirit, and as Bishop Thomas Muthi said, to crush the python, you have to step on its neck, which means, you know, it's a symbolic statement, and what he really meant was that the neck of Satan is in Washington, and that's why they needed to install Sarah into power. And he's also said we need to act more like the Israelites, meaning the Jews. These adherents of the third wave fetishize the Jews and believe all of the stereotypes about Jews controlling the world. But at the same time, unlike neo-Nazis, they don't think those stereotypes are bad. They think those stereotypes are to be emulated. So what they're trying to emulate is a neo-Nazi stereotype of the Jew, and with Sarah Palin as their point person.
Wow. All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Max Blumenthal, and I recommend if anybody wants to get more of this, there's plenty of it in his book, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party, just out from Nation Books. This is WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York, and on the web at WBAI.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back to talk about the working class with Michael Yates. Was some of the first movement of Beethoven's Sonata No. 27 for piano, performed by Alfred Brendel. And we are now joined in the line by Michael Yates, who is a retired professor of economics, who is now a traveling around the United States, filing dispatches from across this great land about the state of things, and also writing a lot and publishing a lot. And he's got a new book out from the Arbeiter Ring Publishers, which is distributed in the United States by AK Press, I believe. This is called In and Out of the Working Class, a collection of essays, bookended by two short stories. Welcome to Behind the News, Michael.
Hi, Doc. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Pretty good. Glad to be on your show again.
Fiction. So I hadn't known until I got this book that you write some fiction now and then, huh?
Well, that's a tough thing to do. I every now and then I've started little pieces, and I wrote the first one in the book, which is called The Year of the Strike, which I thought was pretty good, and then had other people read it, and they thought it was okay. So I included it in this collection of essays that I pitched to Arbeiter Ring, and they liked it. And then I did a couple other ones that are in the book too. There's three in the book altogether, and people have to judge whether they're any good or not, but I enjoyed writing them. And they all fit into the theme pretty well.
Well, I like them, so keep it up.
Good.
So a lot of the book is about your memories and impressions of having grown up in a very distinctive working-class community in Pennsylvania. So tell us a bit about your background and how you ended up becoming a radical economist.
Well, I was born in a little coal mining town about 40 miles north of Pittsburgh on a big bend in the Allegheny River, and it was a company house, tar paper shingles, no central heating, no hot water, outhouse. About a year later, we moved up to a little bigger house, a little better house on a farm of friends of my parents. And
this was the late 40s, early 50s?
Yeah, it was 1946, 47, and then we lived there for a few years. We still had an outhouse, and my dad used to walk a couple miles down to the factory to go to work. It was a big glass factory. It was the biggest glass factory in the world in the little town, Ford City, Pennsylvania. And then in the early 50s, he bought a house up on the hill over the town, getting one of those loans that the government was giving to veterans, and that's where I spent I lived there from about age 5 to 18.
Now, this is the heyday of union labor in the United States, right?
Yeah, it was. Everybody in the town belonged to a union. In fact, my dad, we used to go down for Christmas to get candy at the union hall, and I didn't even think of it as a union hall. I didn't think about a union. I thought every town had a factory whistle and a union hall, and everybody was in the union. I mean, I learned a lot about unions later, but it was lucky for me in a way because the town was pretty vibrant for a small town of 5,000-6,000 people, with a couple movie theaters and bowling alleys and lots of bars and churches and activities, and so I felt like growing up there wasn't a bad thing. It wouldn't be a very good place to grow up now because the union's gone, the factory's gone, and the place is full of people that are really struggling to make a living and suffering all sorts of social dysfunctions. But it was a good time to grow up then. And my parents had aspirations for their oldest child and hoped that I would be able to go to college. And luckily that happened. I did okay in school, and it was tough navigating school when you enjoyed intellectual things in a community where that wasn't always much appreciated. So it was a little bit tough to navigate that, and I talk about that in the book. But anyway, I got to college, and I majored in economics by accident. My dad had to fill out these financial aid forms, and he says, "Mike, you have to have a major." And I said, "Read down the list." And he got biology. I said, "Nah, chemistry, nah." He said, "Economics." I said, "Put that down." And that's how it happened. I really liked economics, and I did really well in it. I did well in college. It was great to be in a place where being smart wasn't a defect. And I got into graduate school at the University of Pittsburgh on a fellowship. But it wasn't until I got to graduate school and at the height of when the Vietnam War was really getting rolling that I started to really reflect on economics and think about things a little more deeply.
Yeah,
and then I was going to be drafted a bunch of times, and I got a job and became a teacher.
The economics profession doesn't like to think very much about class and unions and things like that. You know, it's all the disembodied perfections of the market. How did you reconcile your own personal experiences with what you were learning in graduate school?
Oh, it was horrible. I hated graduate school. Hated almost every minute of it. The only thing that saved me was that the University of Pittsburgh still had a few remnants from, you know, the institutional economists. So they had a couple of people that were, you know, I was able to take a course in, it was called labor union theory. It was sort of like theories of the labor movement from a fellow who actually was my dissertation advisor, and he had gone to MIT and majored in industrial relations and not economics. So that was one thing. And then I had David Houston, who was one of the founders of the Union of Radical Political Economists, was one of my professors, and he was an ardent left-winger, struggling inside the department. He was hired as this hotshot urban economist, and when they found out when he became a Marxist, that was the end of the day for him, so to speak, as far as his academic career was concerned. But I had him and then my friend who was the institutionalist, and so I had some help there in graduate school, but it was really dreadful. I remember in a seminar in labor economics, the professor that I actually liked, we had these seminar meetings, and I was up three straight Wednesday nights for 3 hours to talk about labor unions, and he was saying, "But what do these unions want?" And I just couldn't think of collective action in terms of his intellectual orientation, where everybody's a self-interested maximizer. So
well,
I had a hard time. I had a hard time with it.
Unions are impediments to the self-functioning beauties of the market, aren't they?
Oh yeah, he was a Chicago School economist, and unions are consummate evil to that line of thinking. Right? They're sort of monopolies that push up wages and crowd out non-union workers and that kind of thing. So I had a real problem. Now, the fortunate thing for me probably in the long run was I only was there for 2 years, and then the draft was hounding me. And my political commitments weren't sharp enough then to move to Canada or do something like that. And my advisor said, "You should try to get a teaching job." And I said, "Well, I don't even have a master's degree yet." But luckily, the University of Pittsburgh at Johnstown, one of their regional campuses, was desperate for a teacher because somebody had just turned them down and their only economics professor had quit, and it was August or July. So I applied for the job and got it. And I worked off the rest of my graduate studies part-time, commuting from Johnstown to Pittsburgh. But when I had to teach economics, in light of what was going on in Vietnam and my sharpening thinking about things and then reflecting back on my own life, that's when I really started to move to the left, because I just couldn't teach this stuff. It just didn't make any sense anymore, this guns versus butter and everybody's a maximizer, and what about the war in Vietnam? What about poverty? What about racism? And, you know, you had Gary Becker, the Nobel Prize-winning Chicago school economist, talking about people's taste for discrimination.
Yeah, which
will examination
get,
of
they'll all get competed away by capitalism, right?
Right, exactly, and that wasn't happening. And then I wondered, I said, is that just a fancy word for being a bigot? And anyway, as I taught, my commitment to the left teeth, and then my own life started to make a little bit more sense too, and the lives of my parents started to make a little bit more sense, and you know, their fears and anxieties and all those contradictions. You can't even think about those things inside of neoclassical economics. You know, you need a more radical Marxian viewpoint, I think, of the world to even think coherently about such things.
I'm speaking with Michael Yates, a retired economist, a prolific writer, now out with a collection of essays and a few stories called In and Out of the Working Class from Arbeiter Ring. And one of the things I like about your work is that you don't romanticize the working class. I mean, your story of the town you grew up in is of a community that is very stratified by ethnicity and race and religion. This is not the innocent dynamic working class of what we'd like to see someday.
Oh, no, and it's just so many contradictions in the minds of people. I mean, even attitudes that working people have towards the rich are contradictory to an amazing degree. I have a little story about a rich fellow in a little mining town. He was one of the poorest people in the town, and believe you me, this mining town where I was born and where my grandmother lived, As I say in my book, you know, where my mom and grandma and uncle unloaded dynamite in front of a coal mine when my mom was about 12. This was a poor place, and this guy was among the very poorest people in town, and he made a large fortune in strip mining. A very wealthy person, many houses and lots of money. And if you listen to people talk from the town, on the one hand, oh, man, what an honor to be invited to his house. Man, oh, man, is he rich. You should see all the stuff he has. But then if you were to say, I wonder how he got all that money. Do you think he was hooked in with the mob? And people would say, yeah, probably. They would be just as willing to say negative things as positive things about him. And then, of course, the big dynamic in the factory town, a big dynamic, not so much ethnicity, but a real sharp race dynamic. Just like places where I worked when I worked in Johnstown, PA. I mean, that's such a barrier to the unification of working people is that race. And there's no use glossing over it. I have a story in there that it's painful. It was painful to write and painful to talk about, where I participated in a minstrel show when I was in the ninth grade. The English teacher had us all dressed up in blackface, and they got this script. I don't know if maybe they got it from the Kiwanis Club or someplace, because they used to do that kind of stuff. And we went in front of the whole school and dressed in blackface, and there were black kids in the town and in the audience. And to think about it now just, you know, makes me queasy. But we did it. Nobody said anything about it. We never learned a thing about the civil rights movement, about anything like that. We never learned about unions either, for that matter, in school. So race was a big awful stratifier. I worked in the factory a couple of summers, and you'd hear that day in and day out.
You spent a lot of time the last few years traveling around the country and talking to a lot of people. How does the American working class of today contrast with the one you grew up in?
Well, there's a lot more women in it. That's a really big and important thing, and probably overall progressive thing, although that creates its own kinds of contradictions, too. But when I was a boy, there were women that worked in the factory, but not that many. And they weren't usually very well thought of, you know, that kind of thing. Like maybe there was something wrong with these women that they were working in the factory. So that's one big thing. From when I was a kid, there are a whole lot more, at least where I lived and lots of other places. Maybe it wouldn't be so true for California, but a lot more immigrant workers. Recent immigrant workers. Now, in my hometown, everybody had been an immigrant at one time, but when I grew up, there weren't so many newly arrived immigrants, and so there's a little bit more diversity in the working class now. But on the other hand, I have to say that when I worked at the factory, I worked in the fire hall. I was sort of a secretary in the summers, and the union guys would come in, and working people would come in to have a cup of coffee and talk things over with the union people. And it seemed to me that a lot of the guys were a little bit pretty sharp. They kept up with things and knew a little bit. And when you had strong unions, even though the unions were sharply divided, even though we kicked all the Reds out of the unions and lost our cutting edge, so to speak, still in all, when there was a strong organized working class, the union provided a certain amount of daily education, I would say, to give workers a little bit of consciousness of their circumstances and what to do about it. And, you know, I've been reading about wage stuff a lot. Well, I can tell you, if a worker's pay was a short a nickel, it'd been a riot. In the factory where my dad worked. And now it's just commonplace. So today, you see a working class, probably with some exceptions, not so conscious, not so thinking, not so aware of things, not having any guiding way of thinking about things. And that's a big problem.
Yeah, it seems like bad unions are better than no unions at all.
Well, no, that's certainly true. I mean, I wouldn't say my father's union was all that good of a union. It left a lot to be desired. But still in all, you couldn't cheat a worker out of his pay. You couldn't fire somebody for no reason. You had a grievance procedure. You had a way to wage war. My grandfather, my dad's father, was only got to the eighth grade, but he learned how to be a time study engineer. He time studied my own father in the factory. It's sort of hard to believe, but Grandpa's stopwatch was hated, but the union had at least its own time study engineer. There was like a war going on there, but it was a war in which you had some backing. The union had your back a little bit anyway. And today, for most people, that's just not the case.
Speaking of unions, you've got some stuff in this book, In and Out of the Working Class, but also you wrote a piece for my website at leftbusinessobserver.com about your experience with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, which is a lot less glowing than some of the accounts that other people have written and spoken. So we've only got a few minutes left, but tell us a little bit about the dark side of working with Cesar.
Well, this is just the dark side of unions in general in a lot of ways. This is a disillusioning experience. I had a sabbatical leave, and I went to work for the Farm Workers Union out in California. In fact, I was a minuscule research office that I worked out of. And no, I did some things that were really interesting, but as I was working out there with Cesar Chavez, I mean, he helped me celebrate my 31st birthday in Stockton, California, when we were involved in this big unfair labor practice case. But, man, oh, man, I was there when there was this gigantic purge, and Cesar was hooked in with this Chuck Dierick, who was the head of the Synanon group that was a brainwashing group, a cult-like group. And Cesar picked up this thing called The Game, where Dierick used this to break down the personalities of people that arrived in his drug treatment center, sort of a way to control them. And Cesar used the techniques of That Game to do the same thing inside the union. There were a lot of horrible, ugly purges. I have a story about that. I call it creative nonfiction because it's not verbatim. You know, I invented some dialogue and things like that. This one big meeting where all these people were purged out of the union. And eventually things got worse and worse and worse, and the union became basically a cult as well. Gone downhill ever since. It's sort of a quasi racket now, as I call it. But I got to see that kind of thing up close and firsthand. And it just shows once again, when you have a union without a shred of democracy, the United Farm Workers did not even have local unions. And when the local unions decided to challenge Cesar in the early 1980s in the wake of this big lettuce strike, Cesar clamped down on them, and so did some other people like Dolores Huerta, who were heroes of various kinds of movements. And you see, when that kind of thing happens, you see the importance of democracy within an organization, of a strong rank and file, of the dangers of charisma and charismatic leaders. It was a real learning experience for me. It was a real disillusion. I'm not a big Cesar Chavez fan, as you probably know.
Well, then you also drew some parallels between that experience and what's been happening in the Service Employees Union under Andy Stern in recent years. So we've only got a couple minutes left, but what about that?
Well, that's the same kind of thing, and you notice that there's a lot of people from the Farm Workers Union, as I pointed out in the review on your website, which people, listeners, could look at if they wanted to get a little bit more detail on this. But, you know, you have the same kind of top-down organization. Stern doesn't seem like very charismatic to me, but you have that same
cult of personality without the personality.
Right, exactly. That's a good way to put it. But those same kind of techniques, those same kind of abuse of the organizers, same kind of dictatorial. Except that, of course, Stern's people make a ton of money. Even at the time I worked for the union, nobody was making any money. Now Cesar's kid that runs all these peripheral organizations is making a a fair amount of money. So there's a lot of parallels between what happened inside the Farm Workers Union and what's happening now inside the SEIU. And all I can say in a short period of time is workers beware, because this is not the way you want a labor movement to go. And if the trajectory of my life has taught me anything, that's among many things that it's taught me. That's a really important one. The unions in the United States leave a lot to be desired. Like you say, a bad one's better than none. But you got to, it's a big fight that has to be waged in the United States, and not a very successful one. Not only against your employers, but to get the labor movement itself to do something.
The lesson, among the lessons we learned, it's not a good idea to have a very centralized union with a very strong leader and very weak base, right?
Exactly. All these home health care workers that have been sort of organized from the top down, I mean, they're a malleable base, I suppose, but it's difficult to... Now, of course, the Sal Roselli's group has shown that, you know, you can electrify that base. You can, if you take the time and energy to do it. Stern and company and his people that he got from the farm workers and other places, they're not willing to do that. To them, the union seems to be basically a dues-collecting mechanism and a way in which they can have power and influence.
Well, it's working very well for them. I don't know about everyone else. Thank you for joining us. I've been speaking with Michael Yates, who is a retired economist, now the associate editor of Monthly Review magazine, and also a prolific writer, and has a new collection of essays with a few fictional stories mixed in called In and Out of the Working Class, just published by Arbeiter Ring, which I believe is distributed by AK Press in the United States.
That's right.
Exactly. All right. Thanks for joining us, Michael.
Thanks a lot, Doug. I appreciate it.
That's it for me, Doug Henwood. I'll be back next week, and let's go out with this song about the working class, written by John Lennon, this performed by Marianne Faithfull. Till next week. Bye.